it and occupying its land. So the whole situation is really weird in this case. But the reason is mainly it's not about Druze. Israel doesn't care about Druze. Yes. It doesn't care about anyone.
It's using it as a pretext.
Exactly. It only cares about its own interests.
Okay.
But who doesn't want to normalize with Israel, with Syria is all of Israel. It's not the only some analysts, even Netanyahu, even the cabinet, doesn't prefer normalizing with
Syria. But I don't understand
Syria.
Why, Dr. Muhammad.
It's mainly
as you highlighted, it's a good gesture. Maybe that will... Is it because they will not be able to expand the buffer zone, as the commentator
yes.
highlighted, a few kilometers front?
It's for several reasons. So reason number one, it's because Israel will always search for a reason to expand its territory. So part of expanding its territory is inside of Syria, especially in the south of Syria, since it's the border with occupied Palestine.
Okay.
So it doesn't need to... Israel doesn't need to go to an agreement with Syria that forbids it from occupying parts of Syria,
okay.
number one. And number two, it's because Israel doesn't trust the people today in power in Syria. It also views them as militias, terrorists, that may at a certain point return to having some operations against Israel. So it doesn't trust them. So what it needs, what it's emphasizing for, mm-hmm. is a normalization agreement with Syria,
okay.
but giving it a lot of its interests. Part of them was the Golan Heights. Part of them was the south, all the south of Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Part of them not having Turkey, some military bases inside of Syria. Mm-hmm. So it's mainly like having returning colonialism over Syria.
Yes.
Israel is having it at occupying parts of it.
Okay, but again, they have a golden chance to be allies against Iran. Mm-hmm. And taking into consideration also that Al-Qaeda and ISIS never hit Israel.
Yes,
it's
true.
Kind of confusing when it comes to that.
It's true, but it's not. This is not how Israel thinks. Netanyahu have always spoken about, and he said it in his books, that in relations with the Arab states, only power is the language to use. So they don't believe in the language of peace. They don't believe in the language
because
of
obviously they want to expand. That's only
exactly.
That's the only case they're seeing.
They want to return for the greater Israel, which Syria is part of. So normalizing maybe blocks this. This plan. So they need to expand every phase alone. That's why they prefer to still use power. They think that when they use power, when they destroy the Syrians' military bases, then they will force Syrians towards normalization in the conditions they prefer most.
Yes, okay. What the Israeli entity wants in Syria is only to entrench the occupation of southern Syria and turn it into a demilitarized zone. Everything said about protecting the Jews in Suwayda or elsewhere is meaningless, according to the former deputy chief of staff of the Israeli army. Doesn't such remarks divide or to dissect Syria? It's very painful, and it's like that's exactly what many analysts are analyzing. That's the plan that they're going towards. And now speaking, looking at this report,
you know,
that.
The ironic thing is that nothing is hidden. If you read Israeli official statements, if you read Israeli books from the establishment of Israel in 1948 till now, and if you read these since the beginning of the 20th century, when the idea of creating Israel, establishing Israel was negotiated, since that point, everyone spoke about the greater Israel. Everyone spoke about how Israel has a plan to divide the countries near it. And everyone speaks about how Israel always wants to occupy new lands. So it's all written. Nothing is hidden. It's all written that Israel has no allies. Israel has no friends. Israel doesn't care about anyone in the region, rather than its own interests. And Israel will continue working on dividing the countries in the region.
So they can
and occupying,
expand.
Exactly. And occupying the lands of the countries in the region. So this is written.
But seemingly, Turkey shares the same interest.
You know, the difference between Turkey and Syria is that Turkey is a regional power that has a long history in the region. It's a country that has its own land, its own history and everything. Israel is an entity which was created in order to expand. Hmm. So we have a huge difference between Israel and Turkey. Yes, Turkey at the same point.
But it's for its own benefit for Syria to be divided.
I don't think it's a benefit for Syria to be divided. It's what regional powers want. That Turkey needs part of it. Israel needs part of it. And that's not even a benefit for the Syrian people. For the Syrian people, most important interest is to have the whole of Syria liberated. That's not what's happening today. Every day that passes on, parts of Syria are occupied, mm-hmm. in the south or in the north, it doesn't matter, but parts of Syria are missing. And these parts of Syria are very important to the country on the economic level and on the political level. And that's what the Syrians are paying the price to do so. And let's see how Israel reacted to the Druze issue.
It left, we are the protector of the Druze.
Yes,
now.
It left the, yesterday I saw a number, more than 750 people were killed in the south of Syria. And this is why Israel is protecting them. So I really, no one believes today that Israel really is protecting anyone. Everyone today knows that.
For the Israel, first time we ever heard yes. that Israel is trying to protect any minority in any country. However, wouldn't this fact impact the relationships or the countries that Israel has normalized with, like, for example, Egypt? Well, isn't that a threat to other countries who has already been normalizing with Israel?
Yes, it's not a threat for countries that have been normalizing. It's a threat for everyone in the region. Yes, for everyone in the region. First of all, it's the main threat is for the countries that are on the borders with Palestine. We're speaking about Jordan, Egypt, Lebanon, and Syria, because what's happening in Syria today may happen in any country of these of these four countries. So they feel threatened. Number two, all other regional powers also feel threatened. Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, Turkey, because they feel that now Israel is moving on towards the goal of being the hegemonic power in the region, which mm-hmm. they have no interest
in. At times where the United States is still speaking about Abraham Accords, mm-hmm. and obviously the Israelis are on another dimension
yes,
here.
Yes,
and
exactly.
maybe that will actually cause some kind of diffusion between the two.
Now,
do you agree to that?
Yes.
Because there are two different perspectives here.
Yes, I do agree. I agree to that. But you have to see which perspective will win.
Okay.
The American one, which depends on diplomacy, or the Israeli one, which depends on forcing others to normalize.
Okay. The stalemate in the ceasefire negotiations in the Gaza Strip was addressed by the Israeli media, which considers that there are two unresolved issues that are the subject of discussion with the mediators, the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city. Obviously, the two disputed points in the negotiations are the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city inside Rafah specifically. Do you think there is a possibility of resolving them in preparation for concluding the deal?
Well, to be honest, I don't think that in this round of negotiation there will be ability to conclude the deal, because it's obvious that still Hamas and Israel diverge a lot on several points, especially the point about how Israel wants to continue being inside of Gaza. And they want to continue to be there as a part of continuing of the occupation of Gaza, destroying the resistance and everything. So I think the divergence is still a lot between the two parties, so I don't think the current round will lead to a deal. At the same point,
but what happened here to the American pressure for this deal to take place?
You know,
as if kind
been,
of he retaliated.
Yes, no, we have been having 16
retreated.
Rounds.
Yes,
we have been having 16 rounds of negotiations between Israel and Hamas. In the 16 rounds, if you follow up with the official American statements before every round. Before everyone, most of the American official statements say that we are near to reaching an agreement. We have
yes,
been
very close.
We are very close to reaching the agreement. So it's always what the Americans said. They are always saying we are pressuring Israel, we want to reach an agreement. We are near that. We are close to reaching it, and then they blame Hamas. But we
Trump. He speaks unrealistically about it.
Exactly. But the main problem is that Israel is not able to be, or isn't convinced that it has to leave Gaza. And that's mainly because of its colonial history. Israel wants to be occupying Gaza, and mm-hmm. it doesn't feel now that it's pressured to the level that it has to leave Gaza.
Yeah.
I think that every day passes on, the military pressure on Israel, the diplomatic, the political one, will increase until they are convinced to reach an agreement.
Okay. We remain with the negotiations, the two issues, the Murat Corridor and the so-called humanitarian city. A former Israeli officer told Hebrew media that these two matters are political and their proposal is intended to serve Netanyahu, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. To what extent do you see that the issue of the Murat Corridor and the humanitarian city in Rafah pose a real threat to occupation soldiers who are committing suicide?
Yes, well, I think that you can find the answer in Khan Yunis. You can find the answer in every city inside of Gaza today, where Israeli soldiers are found and already paying the price, and they are already being targeted by the Palestinian resistance. So it's not about expectations, it's about what we're seeing today. So it's obvious today that, yes, Israel can move inside of Gaza. It's obvious also today that Israel can't stay inside stable points inside of Gaza, because there will be a price. And it's obvious that the resistance inside of Gaza, Hamas, is still strong, it still has capabilities, and it can still inflict damage to the Israeli army. And that's the main thing today to understand, is that for almost 2 years of war between Israel and several countries and parties in the region, till now, no strategic goal achieved by Israel. We still have a very strong resistance inside of Gaza, which is leading to giving them the ability to say no in negotiations. If they weren't this strong, then Israel would have
instead been the number of soldiers being killed is on the rise.
Exactly,
Israeli soldiers.
Because every day that passes on, the resistance will adapt more to the type of war they are facing, number one. And number two, it's because Israel is facing a resistance. So if one person is still alive and has weapons, he will fight. So and let's not forget that Palestinians are the one who own the land. So they will never leave their lands and give it to Israel. So all the situation is not with the benefit of Israel, and we are seeing them today. So I think the Morag corridor, the humanitarian city, is not applicable. And the answer for that you can find in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, and many other cities inside of Gaza, where Israeli soldiers are being killed and are being targeted by the Palestinian resistance.
Mm-hmm. And when actually the Israeli side insist on the Morag corridor and on the humanitarian city in Rafah, doesn't that tell us that they're putting their soldiers at very high risk? And wouldn't that damage the relationship between the army and the political side?
Well, I do believe that the relationship is already damaged, but you know, the army at the end of the road has to abide by the rules.
Mistrust?
Yes, of course there's mistrust. Of course they don't believe that Netanyahu is following Israel's interests. Of course the army is too tired. Of course the army is paying a huge price for staying in war for almost 2 years. And this is what they have been saying to Netanyahu for the past several months. But at the end of the road, Netanyahu is forcing others to follow by what he views best, and that's what's mainly inflicting affecting the trust between him and other people inside
of Israel. In addition to threats from some far-right ministers to withdraw from the Israeli government if a ceasefire agreement is reached, there were also threats from ministers of the religious parties to resign from Netanyahu's government if the Haredi draft crisis is not resolved. To what extent do you think that there is a real possibility for the Shas party members, as we highlighted in this report, has been highlighted in the report, to resign from the government if members of the United Torah Judaism party resign over the Haredi draft crisis?
Well, I think, yes, Israel faces a huge problem today regarding the Haredi crisis. And, you know, it's more deep than only the Haredi crisis. It's about trust between Netanyahu and different factions inside of Israel. So it's about between him and the liberals, between him and the Haredi, between him and the army, between him and other political parties. So there is really a political division inside of Israel, which is escalating throughout time. And this may lead nearly to a point where, yes, Chas may resign and other political parties may resign. And it's ironic that, who are the Haredis? They are the most religious people inside of Israel. Okay. So the most religious people inside of Israel are being divided because of what? Because they don't believe that the army is a suitable place for them to be inside. They don't believe in defending Israel. They believe that the others should defend Israel, not them. These are the most religious people inside of Israel that don't believe that they should take part in defending Israel. And they also promote that the army is not suitable for religious people. So this is how much divided Israel is today.
Okay, and how would that develop in the coming days if this division continues?
Well, I always
because obviously they are every now and then when we get close to a ceasefire, they threaten
Yes, they used to threaten
to retire.
They used to threaten that before based on how they view the war. Now they feel that they are threatened. It's not about soldiers being threatened, not about Israel's interests, it's about their own interests. That's why I always say Israel in the future, everyone is speaking about it facing more strategic failures. One of them is this division.
Okay, the Israeli commentator actually mentions a deadline of just 2 days for religious parties to withdraw from the government if Netanyahu does not find a solution to the Haredi draft issue. Do you think that is possible?
Yes, I do think that's possible because they won't give Netanyahu the chance to negotiate with them, try to pass the laws he is trying to pass, that they think that they affect them negatively. Mm-hmm. So at the point where they find that there's no deal that can be achieved, and Netanyahu is insisting on continuing with the Hariri project.
What would happen then to Netanyahu's government?
Well, it depends on how much people resign from the government, and it depends on how much he can convince other parties to fill the blank place inside of the government. So, I think if the Haredi do resign, then Netanyahu will surely have a huge problem inside the cabinet, and I think that he will then go towards early elections. But you know, the problem inside of Israel is even today.
Yes, a lot are speaking about early elections and how he's very interested in that.
Yes, because all the surveys show that if early elections happen today, then he will return as being the prime minister of Israel. Mm-hmm. So, but the problem with Netanyahu is even if he returned being prime minister, and I think that early elections is one of the most possible scenarios today, the problem is that his coalition won't be stable. It's always him with others, and he needs others for the whole coalition to form a cabinet. Mm-hmm. And his views with the other parties' views are diverging a lot, with the Haredis, with the liberals, with the opposition parties and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's always Israel's political parties, political cabinet, will always be divided, and that's the most important thing to concentrate on.
Okay. Israeli social media reacted to the rising death toll among the occupation soldiers in the Gaza Strip and strongly criticized the Netanyahu government's attempts to appease the Haredim by exempting them from military service. Here are some of the comments.
Sagit Abu: in the Knesset, we knew about the deaths of the three soldiers in Gaza. Nevertheless, we witnessed the shameless begging by the governing coalition toward the Haredim to stay in the government after promising not to pass the Haredi draft law for the army. Yuzi Shoham: if opposition leaders come to power, they'll give the Haredim every budget they want in exchange for votes. No one will object then, because drafting the Haredim was never the opposition's goal. The goal has always been, and still is, to bring down the coalition. Hantri Stanit: while the country bleeds, the governing coalition plays its political game. That is how this government operates.
Dr. Mohammed Suwaydan, academic and writer in international affairs, thank you very much for joining us in this episode.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications, so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior, Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Mahdi. May Allah hasten his reappearance. So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service speaking about the dialogues of the awaited Savior of humanity, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. So, we're kind of picking and choosing between various questions and answers in this back and forth that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, has with an individual by the name of Muhammad ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far, who is one of his followers. And, you know, this individual, he poses various questions to His Eminence, His Eminence answers these questions. So we're kind of picking and choosing the interesting ones, the ones that are kind of interesting to speak about. You know, one question that Muhammad ibn Abdullah asks, he says that it has been narrated from our previous scholars, when it comes to the reward of the Holy Quran, when you recite it in the prayers, he says, it is astonishing that a person who does not recite Suratul Qadr in his prayer, how is his prayer accepted, right? So the first question is, if you don't recite Suratul Qadr in your daily prayers, then your daily prayers are not accepted. And then he says that it is narrated that a person who recites Suratul Ikhlas, Qul Huwallahu Ahad, until the end in their prayers, does not recite it in their prayers, that prayer does not scale the heights of honor. And that on the other hand, one who recites Suratul Humaza in his prayers, they would get the reward equal to the whole world. So then, should one recite Suratul Humaza and not recite the other surahs and the other chapters of the Holy Quran in the prayers? What happens to the purity and loftiness of these prayers, you know, because you can't read every single one of them, is what is being asked. So they're saying that, you know, Suratul Qadr, Suratul Ikhlas, how can a prayer be accepted if they're not recited? And on the other hand, Suratul Humaza, if it is recited, then it has also great rewards. His Eminence, he replies to these questions and he says that, yes, the rewards of the surahs and the chapters of the Holy Quran to be recited in the prayers that you have said is correct, meaning there's great value to Suratul Qadr, there's great value to Suratul Ikhlas, and there's great value to Suratul Humaza. Suratul A'la is also another one that is recommended. Suratul Jum'ah is also recommended. These two I'm adding myself so that we know that there are also other surahs that are of value. But His Eminence says if one leaves the other surahs that are eligible for rewards and instead recites Suratul Ikhlas or Suratul Qadr, because of the merits of these two chapters of the Holy Quran, they would get the rewards of the other surahs that they have, that they would have recited, but they didn't. And of course, you can recite other surahs in the namaz, in the prayer, and the prayer will still be correct. So a very beautiful manner that His Eminence answered these questions, and a very beautiful way that he answered these questions and brought clarity to a situation which was quite confusing. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. IRIB English Radio, our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. Now we invite you to listen to Brother Khalil Ja'far.
There is a verse of the Quran where Allah says, وَآتَيْنَا الثَّمُودَ نَاقَةً مُبْصِرَةً فَظَلَمُوا بِهَا. We brought to the people of Thamud a camel. It was brought from a carving on a cave, and it was brought to life. A real camel came out of the wall to them. And yet they slaughtered and hamstrung the camel and killed it. وَمَا نُرْسِلُ بِالْآيَاتِ إِلَّا تَخْوِيفًا. We do not send miracles and signs except as a deterrent to people. So that then tells us that miracles have a certain purpose in Allah's eyes. The idea of a miracle is not to provide proof, if I can put it that way, but to provide added proof, meaning that the miracle only shows you that this prophet or this messenger or this imam has a special position with Allah, such that when he asks Allah for something, his prayer is not refused. But it does not in itself give you a conviction that will not leave you or eliminate hypocrisy from the heart. It is also used as a deterrent, as the Quran says, so that those who are evil are held back because they realize that if this person prays for something, it will affect us. Such as Fir'aun, for example, when the Prophet Musa alayhi salam prays for pestilence, for locusts, and for the firstborn in all the Egyptian family to die, all these things happen. So it serves as a deterrent to them. But in itself, it is not meant to bring human beings to prove. Why? Because Allah does not want human beings to be convinced of the truth only by miracles and signs. There is no greatness in that. Greatness lies in attaining conviction through purifying oneself, through realization, through the intellect, through understanding, rather than just miracles, where one may then argue, well, I was hypnotized, or well, there was a scientific explanation to this, or well, I don't know if it really happened, or well, it happened 1,000 years ago, I want to see that for myself. And that is why we argue that the greatest miracle is the Quran, even though the Messenger of Allah performed many other miracles. A lot of times you will find, if you look at the internet as well, you will see Christians will argue on this basis. They will say, oh, Jesus was better than Muhammad because Jesus could bring the dead back to life, he could heal the lepers, he could give the blind sight, he could do this, he could do that. What could your prophet do? And then we argue back and say, well, he split the moon, and when he holds pebbles in his hands, they would do tasbih, and a tree moved from its place. And now these were true. The prophet did do those. But that is not the line of argument. Because when Jesus himself came and he performed these miracles, the people denied him. Most of them denied him, except the Hawariyun or the disciples. He took clay and built a bird out of that and fashioned it. And with the permission of Allah, he would breathe life into it and it would fly and become a living creature. They would still deny it and say, this is magic. So he had to perform miracles to involve them in the miracle.
Thank you. for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Antonio Gramsci, the Italian Marxist philosopher who coined the term cultural hegemony, believes soft power is the main cause of hegemony. He believes only those governments can impose their hegemony that exercise persuasive power as well as direct force. With the end of the Cold War, the United States used its military, political, economic, and media capacity to carry out different operations in countries caught up in civil war. And with its political and economic reforms, it tried to build its desired society in target countries and empower forces dependent on itself in those countries. This way, it could complete its power puzzle over the world. American imperialism has always been hand-in-hand with American exceptionalism. Ever since the idea of the Destiny Manifesto gained influence in the 19th century, the United States extended its own presence and influence not only from beach to beach in North America, but also across all nations of the world. Perhaps what's most evident about America in power games is that it is a novice with imperial equations. In the 19th century, when European powers, especially England and France, were building their vast external empires, the United States was still busy with committing genocide against Native Americans and with its civil wars. In the 1890s, when the United States had stretched across from beach to beach, the next step was to go beyond its borders and occupy other parts of the world. Another concept connected to a tradition of American exceptionalism is finding a spiritual goal for war. This approach means to conceal inhumane American acts in time of war with these other nations. As Harry Stout, the American missionary, has said, America's belief is in war as a religious tool and a holy commitment all over the world. Some thinkers believe Westernization of the world is a continuation of its Christianization, and that this trend continues in a different, reconstructed form. Globalization of the West has roots in pre-Renaissance Christianity. The nature of Western Christianity post-Renaissance has itself undergone change in the process of becoming worldly and global. But globalization is actually one and the same as historic Western religious and cultural and civilizational expansionism on the rise. Actually, distorted Christianity in the West now directly serves to spread Western civilization and thought. The method of comparing religious belief and the new Western culture is also very interesting.
But we're burning something and we're actually convinced of it. Yeah. And according to the Bible, it's actually true what we're saying.
The behavioral pattern of Western culture has been reconstructed based on moral tolerance advocated by distorted Christianity. And to other nations, this moral tolerance is a sign of progress in Western civilization and piety. In other words, via globalization, it is possible to become both Christian and hedonistic, and also progressive and civilized in choosing a Western interpretation of life, humankind, society, nature, and history. As a matter of fact, to the young generation of the world, the allure of globalization is this very characteristic of Western civilization. Of course, there's much to be said also from the other side of the story. Religious elements have never easily faced accepting the infiltration of Western culture.
General MacArthur's charge.
After World War I and understanding the importance of expanding international relations, international organizations were established to monitor human rights observance. This slowly weakened the national sovereignty of countries. Some thinkers believe a traditional religious outlook saw itself confronted by the international community's social, cultural, and political currents. This caused the Salafi school of thought to enter into an unprecedented war with Western civilization in the early 21st century. An occurrence clearly evident in the attack on the New York Trade Center Twin Towers. This incident signifies the conflict between religious understanding and globalization. Of course, there are other interpretations of the incident also, which say all relevant currents, such as the Twin Tower explosions, were pre-planned by Westerners. Despite all these interpretations, some believe the 21st century will see the world turn to religion. Many people are adopting Christianity, Islam, and Buddhism. However, taking to Islam has a totally different reason. People are becoming Muslim because they are critical of the conditions and situation of Western civilization and the globalization trend.
I describe what seems to me to be a central feature of the post-Cold War world as far as international politics is.
Samuel Huntington, a political science expert, has a theory called the Clash of Civilizations. He had predicted that after the Cold War, the source of all conflict would be religious culture and identity.
Who are we? The challenges to America's national identity.
He had predicted the tug of war between the Western world and Muslim world. The truth of the matter is, one of the greatest impediments to Western civilization infiltrating Middle Eastern societies is Islam. As an example, we can study Lebanon. Although European and American missionaries had set up plenty of schools and media in Lebanon, the Lebanese resistance movement took form with a completely Islamic identity in the 1980s in the atmosphere of security and identity conflict. William Raff, an American Foreign Service officer and political theoretician, believes the positive view Arabs had of America was damaged for several reasons. Raff believes the first reason is the issue of Palestine. Arabs are angry with America for its all-round support of the regime occupying Al-Quds.
Christian Zionism, at its simplest, is Christian support for Zionism. But we need to unpack that. Today, Zionism is essentially a secular movement driven by Jewish people who believe that they have a right to historic Palestine, and we see in the present policies of the Israeli government quite a racist, supremacist approach to claiming the land, colonizing the land, driving Palestinians off their historic homeland, instituting laws that preference Jewish people over non-Jews, and so on. Christian Zionism is primarily a religious movement with political implications.
Another reason is that Western powers have insulted the character of the Prophet of Islam on different occasions, offending Muslim pride. Yet another reason is that on the 9th anniversary of the 9/11 act of terror, a radical pastor called Terry Jones announced he meant to hold a ceremony to set the Quran on fire.
We are going to have an international burn a Quran day.
Every non-Muslim is an infidel. Their lands, their women, their children are our spoils.
And finally, the making of the film Innocence of Muslims in 2012. incensed Muslims to a point that American embassies were attacked in several Muslim countries. All these measures have weakened U.S. soft power among Muslims. Of course, in addition to points made by RAF, there have been other instances of insult to the Prophet of Islam and Muslims. For example, the film Fitna, meaning cause of division, made in 2008 by a Dutch politician, which provoked a global backlash. Also, a trend started of drawing caricatures of the Prophet of Islam, the first of which was by the Danish newspaper Jyllands-Posten. All such acts hurt Muslim pride globally.
At the beginning of the 19th century, you find Christian leaders advocating for the return of the Jewish people to Palestine because they believe this is what their scriptures mandated. So Christian Zionism preceded Jewish Zionism by at least 50 years. And then in terms of its presence today, we have to say that 9 out of 10 Zionists today are Christians. So although we associate Zionism with Jews and with Israel, the irony is that 9 out of 10 Zionists today are Christians. And so although as a minority, it's a secular political philosophy or movement, the reality is that the great majority of Zionists today are religious and they are Christian. They're driven by the belief that somehow the contemporary Israel is the fulfillment of promises God made in the Bible to his chosen people.
An instance of U.S. meddling in other countries' internal affairs came to be seen in color revolutions, a post-communist occurrence. A color revolution is an anti-violence revolution for regime change. After the Cold War, color revolutions were rolled out in Eastern Bloc countries to totally eliminate the two great barriers before U.S. hegemony, China and Russia.
He's one of the richest men in the world. He's given away a staggering $32 billion. But is the billionaire philanthropist George Soros at the heart of a global conspiracy?
When you look at the entirety of what the foundations have done, it's been very worthwhile and very effective. Yet if you look at individual programs, many have failed. We have had many difficulties. In Russia, we have had about three putches where the foundation had to be cleaned up. So it's been one long struggle with lots of difficulties, but when you look at the results, very rewarding.
An institute obviously involved in guiding color revolutions is the Open Society Institute, OSI, owned by an American Jewish capitalist called George Soros. This foundation evaluates dissidents to the central government in countries of interest to provide the grounds for peaceful revolution by providing financial support to anti-government student movements.
Trying to improve the world is more difficult than making money. You can only measure it if you have a strategy. I set up a foundation to promote this idea of an open society. Opening up closed societies, making open societies function better, and foster a critical mode of thinking.
For example, with the Rose Revolution in Georgia or Orange Revolution of Ukraine, anti-central government groups succeeded in creating structural change with support from this foundation. Of course, the U.S. government's footprints can be traced anywhere popular protest has been guided against the legitimate government. For example, in the Middle East, where the Syrian civil war is the most recent and bitterest example. The American strategy till before 2011 was after a way to topple Assad. When Islamic Awakening sprouted in early 2011, the Obama administration grabbed it as a chance to oust Assad. When Assad proved his steadfastness, Obama ordered the CIA to align with Saudi and Turkish efforts for toppling the regime by supporting anti-regime local fighters, including mercenaries supported by Saudi Arabia. But the quick ousting of Assad, which American strategies dreamt of, turned into a full-scale local war which only set fire to the Syrian people's lives. For the moment, America's general diplomacy policy in the Middle East is basically in line with reducing negative impacts of its military meddling. This is why a theoretician such as Joseph Nye stresses time and again that to infiltrate other nations, America must take a path of imposing soft power, so that other wrong tactical calculations that damage U.S. credibility with Middle Eastern nations and governments do not occur. Joseph Nye compares the distribution of power in the world to a three-dimensional chessboard, at the head of which is military power and the world's only power, the United States. The next rung of power is economic. Power at this level is multipolar, balancing between America, Europe, China, and Japan. But on the third row of the chessboard is external relations, meaning occurrences beyond the control of governments. Instances such as global warming, pandemics, and drug smuggling. At this stage, the only practical solution is cooperation between nations and governments. And there is no other solution. Nye believes the zero-power summary game is no longer any use. What is of use is the positive power summary, meaning there are no more winners and losers in the world.
People like Joseph Nye and others, to some extent, speculate upon what this post-Cold War era will look like in terms of the international sphere. So what you see is an understanding, or an analysis at least, that we're moving to a much more flexible, a much more dynamic consideration of power, i.e. in the Cold War period we have essentially two blocks, capitalist and communist. We've also got a non-aligned movement, but we have these two kind of hegemonic blocks competing with each other, and the two, well, let's just say that it's quite a simple scenario where good conduct, for example, is only a small part of the requirement here. So states that we might hold up as being more moral actors, you know, states that are not, for example, dictatorships, or states that don't suppress their people in different ways, they almost have more of a, are perhaps received better in the international community, at least on whichever side they align to. However, as we move into the post-Cold War period, there's an understanding that, as I say, the definition or the consideration of power, and particularly what matters or what counts when it comes to power, is a bit more is a bit more flexible. So soft power is, I guess, as I say, this an identification that things are changing.
It's noon in Los Angeles, 3 o'clock in Washington, and four big stories are developing right now.
In today's political equations, what's most important is superiority of narrative. Even a 30-second commercial film advertising shampoo or toothpaste will bear no effect if it's not successful in its narrative. For a text to be effective, its narrative must be seemingly correct and simple. Joseph Nye points to the importance of narrative given what the time calls for. In our times, anyone winning the war of narratives is the final winner. Now, these American narratives, spun by a few non-governmental organizations, try to paint the United States in a positive, holy, humane, and peaceful light.
To officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
The move comes with consequences, and American embassies around the world are already bracing for trouble.
Talk about the emergency response now. You see there Isabel Coleman. She is the deputy administrator at USAID. Isabel, I know this is a very busy time for you and your organization, so thank you for joining us. We understand some aid from the States is on the ground in Turkey and in Syria. Tell us about what's already there and about the commitment you're making for what's ahead.
Yes, thank you. I mean, it really is just an unbelievable situation. We were able to get two of our search and rescue teams on the ground in Turkey yesterday.
It is the nature of cultural change in societies to be gradual and slow. So to fully observe the cultural effects of a phenomenon, one must be patient.
If our culture is unattractive to others, then a given cultural artifact doesn't produce soft power. It may produce the opposite. It may produce revulsion. So if you take an American TV program or American film in which women are shown running around in bikinis and divorcing their husbands and working, and you show that in Saudi Arabia, that's not attractive to the religious conservatives who rule those countries. But there is an interesting dimension to that. If you ask, is Baywatch attractive to run Iran? Clearly not. Doesn't create any soft power. But if you ask, what do young Iranian teenagers want? They want to see an American video in the privacy of their homes. So you can attract some people and repulse or repel others at the same time.
Perhaps more time is needed to study the effects of America's cultural measures on Middle Eastern belief, behavior, and lifestyle. A foundation such as USAID, in addition to its economic activities, exacts plenty of focus, expense, and energy on cultural activity in target countries. Change made in the lifestyles of these people is evident enough, but perhaps it has not yet reached its climax. Even so, if we monitor the activities of these supposedly cultural organizations, such as USAID, USEP, and NED, we can pinpoint and predict key cultural changes to come with high accuracy.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Ilm-e Fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.